Remember, tomorrow we have chapel also. Ordinarily we do not gather on Thursday. But you better bring your clocks tomorrow and check them, because Dr. Tanner is going to be talking about that fascinating subject and controversial subject about what is time. I don't know what time it's going to be. Many of us already know that Dr. Tanner is a very distinguished geologist. The three outstanding geology departments in America are, by the calculation of those who know best and allocate funds, are Oklahoma, Florida State, and Wisconsin. And Dr. Tanner has been a professor at both places, has been associated with both the University of Oklahoma and Florida State University. Despite that, some of our professors are already challenging some of his statements. I understand that you're going to have an opportunity to talk back to him. They kept asking me, I said, what does he believe about this and that and the other? I said, well, on Friday at 11, he'll be in, on Thursday at 11, he'll be in my class. On Friday at 11, he'll be in Dr. Cunningham's class. Dr. Tupper got so worked up that he invited him for 2 o'clock this afternoon to his class. Now, is not the most serious challenge. Dr. Owens came in this morning and said he's all wrong on creation being last Friday. So I got it marked down here. He said, right here it says plainly. See, Chancellor Lightfoot of Cambridge calculated a long time ago, 4004 BC on October the 23rd, 9 o'clock in the morning with the clouds full of water. So, Doctor, you might want to take that into consideration next time. Now, I'm really interested in what he's going to speak about this morning, because about 3 weeks ago, I fell out of the top of one of those birch trees. A lot of gossip went on about what was wrong with me. The one that I resent most is one that Dr. Tate was circulating as a rumor. Said I was up in the top of the tree looking for one of my ancestors. So, Dr. Tanner, we will listen this morning, but remember, you are before people who dare to challenge.
Thank you, Dr. Moody. I want to take this opportunity to express my appreciation to him for taking me on a field trip yesterday. And if you have not been to one of his favorite sites, you should make arrangements to go and see that. Because you do not have to go to Florida to visit a tropical coral reef. You can see it right across the river from Louisville in fossil form. On Thursday morning, I do want to share some time with you on the doctrine of time. I think this is a most difficult concept, a most slippery concept, and we have a great deal of trouble with it, but it's worth looking into, and I think we can come out with some new insights. Any number of interesting and I think important things pop up out of that. Let me mention just one of them for you. What happens to the reconciled soul after the body has died and before the resurrection? Well, that'll be tomorrow. This morning I want to address the question of, is there a monkey in the family tree? And I will limit my remarks to the student body at Florida State University, where it is quite obvious that there is a monkey in there. Nothing said, but I'm reminded of the comment that the famous comedian Lou Lair made some few years ago. In his Pennsylvania Dutch, which is Deutsch, of course, German, in his Pennsylvania Dutch accent, which I will not attempt to imitate. He said monkeys is the craziest people, and he was mistaken. People is the craziest monkeys. Is there a monkey in the family tree? This can be the basis for a flamboyant operation of some kind, and I don't propose to go at it that way. I'm very serious about the business of sharing some thoughts with you this week. And it's going to take me about 8 or 10 minutes to get around to mentioning a monkey. I want to set the stage for that first. And in order to do that, I want to take you with me as we look at some things that a specialist sees easily and that a non-specialist may not see at all, even though he is walking on them and staring at them. There is a dirt road that runs westward from a point about 25 kilometers north of the city of Uruapan in Mexico, going toward the village of Los Reyes. This is a bad road, a dirt road, in the vicinity of a cluster of huts called Angawan. On the south side of the dirt road, there is a volcano. It has the classical cinder cone structure, the kind you see in photographs and paintings. It juts hundreds of meters above the adjacent hills, and this is the volcano Paricutin, which developed, first erupted in a cornfield in 1943 as a hissing noise in a fissure through the, a little crack, through the dried dirt. A farmer was plowing the field with his burro and had stopped to smoke a cigarette. And he was fascinated and then frightened to see the first evidences of a new volcano where no volcano had been before. Very quickly, it built a cone a few centimeters high. This was a baby volcano. You like babies? A little tiny baby volcano. He was scared to death. He rushed into town, went to see the pharmacist, who was the drugstore owner and operator, who was the only fairly well-educated person in town, and told him that he had flipped his cigarette butt away, and where it landed, he had set the world. Over a period of 12 years, Paricutin grew to be a major volcano about 400 meters high. During this interval, it poured forth hot lava and cinders and ash and a tremendous quantity of smoke of various colors, white, gray, and black. It buried the nearby town of San Juan Parangaricutiro. That's the short version of the name. First with ash, and then with lava. For a while, the people who lived there took their brooms up on the flat roofs and tried to sweep the ash off the roofs. And they could not keep up with the rate at which the ash was falling. And they gave that up, and soon the roofs were collapsing from the weight of the ash fall. In due time, hot lava from the volcano invaded the village, and in a few years it had been abandoned. In 1950, the only thing, 7 years later, the only thing that was left visible as an indication of where the village had stood was the church steeple, which stuck up through and still stood above the cold, solidified lava flows. In the last days of its activity, this volcano had a series of very violent explosions and ejected a series of hot blocks, each of which weighed more than, each of the bigger ones, weighed more than 100 tons. This is like half a dozen tractor trailer rigs, fully loaded, one hot block. Out past the volcano, past its base, and into the adjacent cornfields. When I went down and visited this volcano, everything was quiet. There was a mist hanging over the peak, and if you had stood there and looked at it then, you might very well have said, it has always been like that. We now call this volcano dormant. Perhaps it is dead, we don't know. That will depend on what happens in the future. But we've studied its history intensively. Many geologists who risked their lives climbing up into the field of hot flowing lava in order to learn more about what a volcano does. And that is a risk of your life when droplets of lava and big blocks, such as I mentioned a moment ago, at temperatures something like 8 or 10 times as hot as the kitchen oven, are moving past you. The crater was born. It grew to maturity, very impressive maturity. And finally, the activity died down to a whisper. Now it is dormant. Surtsey erupted under the waters of the Atlantic Ocean just south of Iceland in 1963 and quickly built a large cone up above sea level and formed the island of Surtsey. In a few years, the lava and the ash and the smoke and the cinders had ceased, and the volcano is now dormant and appears to be dead. It went through some kind of a life cycle. But we do not know that its story is over. Krakatoa, a tree-covered mountain almost 800 meters high between Sumatra and Java, vanished in a huge explosion in 1883. We'll celebrate the 100th anniversary of the explosion of Krakatoa in 2 more years. And that will take lots of people to meeting places for conventions and programs of all kinds, because this was a big event. The sound of the main explosion when Krakatoa blew up was heard 5 hours later in Australia. It was heard on the coast of India and was heard along the east coast of Africa, which is roughly 5,000 kilometers away. That's quite a noise. Barometers in weather offices all over the world picked up the shock wave. And ash in the atmosphere was visible through North America and Europe for some 2 years afterward. It changed the color of sunrise and sunset as evidence for the tremendous quantity of material that was ejected into the air and encircled the globe. About 36,000, more than 36,000 people were killed by the big waves that were created in the immediate vicinity when this thing exploded. The first people who went into the area afterwards discovered that the mountain was gone completely, and instead of a mountain that had been 800 meters high, there was a hole extending downward 300 meters below sea level, so a total difference of 1,100 meters and all of the material sticking out to the side in the cone, this was all blown up into the air in one big explosion. What has this volcano been doing in the 98 years that it has been quiet, dormant, but not dead? It has built a new cone, starting as a little one and building up in the crater in the old pit that was made when it exploded, and it is now showing signs of increasing activity. And it could be that the 100th anniversary celebration will be celebrated by the volcano in addition to by the people. I think it's pretty clear that it will erupt violently again, and if it doesn't make it in 1983, it will make it in the not too distant future beyond that. It has a life cycle, and one that we have been able to study for almost 100 years now, and it is continually changing. And I see no reason to think that one cycle will be the end of the story. Each year, the Mississippi River and its main tributaries, rise in the annual spring flood, and they carry tremendous quantities of water and other material. This includes both solid load, stuff that gives it its color, and some material moving along the bed, and substances that are dissolved in the water. Other rivers in the United States carry a load each year also. They're not as big, but there are more of them. The total load that's carried each year by rivers in the United States or by any other area with rivers is fantastic. We could not supply that much with the longest freight train that we know. Since the coming of the Europeans to North America, bringing a form of agriculture that the Indians did not practice, the annual erosion rate has been some centimeters per century. That much is gone every year. It varies from not too much in the east to a great deal in the west per century. But just one centimeter in a century is 100 meters in a million years. And in 10 million years, it's a kilometer. And that's taking off a lot of stuff. And if we correct a little bit for the fact that the Indians did not plow in the way that we do, that changes the figures, but only in a small way. These are not fanciful numbers. You're standing on the surface that is left as this process operates. You can go onto mountain systems like the Rocky Mountains, and up high in the peaks, you can see the fragments that are still left of old ground surfaces that were there millions of years ago. We have stripped away a sheet of rock kilometers thick in order to make the ground surface on which you and I walk. In the case of a single stream, such as the Mississippi or the Ohio out here, we see an important process, sediment transport. This happens to be my own area of specialty. This process has a beginning. We call that erosion. Material is carried away from the land. It also has a termination. We call that deposition, somewhere on the edge of the continent. The erosion shows us that the land surface is gradually being worn down, and this goes through a history of some kind. And the deposition, the building of a delta somewhere on the edge of the sea, shows us that some space filled only with water near the continental margin is being filled up. This shows a history of some kind. The stream, however, continues to connect the part that is being eroded with the part where deposition is taking place. And because both of those regions are changing, the river is changing. Therefore, when you stand on the banks of a muddy river in flood time and you observe the dirty brown color, you are watching the farms of Kentucky and the wheat fields of Kansas go by. And it's a one-way trip. You should make an impressive comment. You should think a deep thought. And that thought might be, I am watching the life cycle not only of a river, but of a continent. I live in Tallahassee, in Florida. And I lived there for a reason. It is not true that that was the only job I could get. This is close to a sandy coast where wave energy levels are not too high. Immediately south of Tallahassee, the average breaker height in the surf zone on the coast, don't tell the Florida Chamber of Commerce I said this, is only that high. Tourists don't come to that part of the coast. And as I work my way westward along the Florida Panhandle coast, the breakers get bigger and bigger, and by the time I get to the Florida-Alabama line, they're all the way up to that. Well, this for me is ideal. Along high energy coasts, the kind the surfers like, with big waves, the processes that work there move so rapidly that I cannot study them. If I go to a truly zero energy coast, we have them on the open ocean. I have people from all over the world come to visit me because they're sure I'm lying. And they want to go see where you can observe the edge of the open ocean, and the little waves are only that big. Well, in a storm, they get up to be about that big. Along a zero energy coast, processes move so slowly that you can't tell they're happening, and so I live in an area where I can get to a coast in between, an easy access coast where I can see what's going on and can watch wave energy and sand as it's redistributed along the coast. We can use the terms youth and maturity to describe the changes that take place along that coast. Glaciers can be observed to develop. Some of you have seen them. If you've never seen one, you should go see one. They have not always been present where they are today, and they will not always continue to be present in the same location. The big ice sheet, which covered the eastern third of Canada and the northeastern one quarter of the United States, and which shaped the Ohio River path here, this big ice sheet, up until about 10,000 years ago, we had it. It had grown from nothing and built a tremendous ice sheet, kilometers thick at the thickest part, and then melted away, leaving thousands of footprints that the geologist can see and can interpret in terms of a history, a life cycle of some kind. A compass, a hand compass. Buy a cheap one in the dime store and hold it in your hand, and you can use that to map the Earth's magnetic field. This field has local peculiarities, and these peculiarities change from year to year. The main features of the magnetic field drift slowly westward, and small features do some other things. And the changes are so rapid that a magnetic map must be brought up to date and reprinted every 10 years because it's not good any longer than that. In fact, 10 years is being generous. In New York City, a simple compass needle does not point north. Doesn't point north in Louisville either. Points west of north by a few degrees. And a correction must be made. And that correction depends on where you are and when you are there. Even here in Louisville, a simple uncorrected compass will not give you the north direction. Furthermore, if you come back to Louisville 100 years from now, and I'll congratulate you on that occasion, the correction will be markedly, will require a correction markedly different from the correction that you make today. The other terrestrial planets have no planet-wide magnetic field. Mercury has none. Venus has none. The moon, which is the size of a small planet and made up of the same stuff, has no planet-wide magnetic field. Compass is useless in these places. Mars has no planet-wide magnetic field. You live on a unique planet, a combination of rock and a magnetic field. The sun has a magnetic field, but you can't live on the surface. Jupiter has a magnetic field, but we haven't even found the surface. And you certainly can't live there. We presume that the Earth's magnetic field will decay in the remote future so that a compass will be useless on the Earth here also. There was a time back in early Earth history when there was no magnetic field. There have been some changes, haven't there, in the magnetic field. Meanwhile, we do have one. It has its ups and downs. The features drift westward. They fade and come back. They change place. They change shape. The features on the magnetic map. On a few occasions, they drop to zero, and there is, for a short period of time, perhaps about 100 years, no planet-wide magnetic field on the Earth, and then it is reconstituted, and it may be reconstituted with the North Pole at the South Pole, which is a very interesting piece of confusion. But that happens every now and then on our planet. Get out with your compass after that, and you see which way the needle points, and you say, okay, there's a correction that must be made, but in addition to that, you don't know which end it's pointing toward. The Earth's rotation is not fixed. The rate at which it turns on its own axis is not fixed. And so the day is continuously changing in value. There are slow, long-term changes. I'm reluctant to share with you what they are, because many people can't believe that we can measure this, but the day is becoming 2 seconds longer every 100,000 years. But unfortunately for setting your watch, there are short-term changes in both directions, so that the day is not fixed in length. Projected into the geological future, this shows us that at some time the day will come to the state where it contains 8,766 hours. Then it'll quit changing very much. Why 8,766 hours? Because that's 1 year. And apparently the day cannot lengthen beyond that. At that time, one side of our planet will be in perpetual daylight, and the other side will look out into the darkness of cold and empty space. One side will be very hot, with no nighttime to cool off. And the other side will be very cold, with no daylight in which to warm up. That's not an idle prediction. Mercury has reached that condition already. One day is 1 year. Venus is very close to it, and the Earth is on its way. The universe is going through a very rapid expansion. At one time in the past, it was very much smaller than it is now. It may not have been the whole universe. It may not have been much bigger than a basketball. The rate of expansion is so fast that it has blown outward from that original source, however big or small it was, to its present mind-boggling expanse in some 20 or 30 billion years. Date's not too precise that far back, and hard to keep track of it. Did anything exist before we had a ball full of packed material that would blow up to make the universe? We don't have the foggiest idea. It's possible that it did. There's nothing in science or in the Bible to say that it did not. But the evidence of the explosion is everywhere, and the universe is changing from day to day. It is getting more spread out, more diffuse, if you like. And we have a future ahead of us that is different from the present, and the present is different from the past. I've given you a few examples because I want you to come away from this lecture with one or two very clear ideas. I've not mentioned other examples that I could give you. The history of the atmosphere, it is changing, it has been changing. The changes in mean sea level. Big changes in mean sea level, changes in mountain systems, changes in lakes, changes in countless things. In fact, just about everything is changing. The everlasting hills are not everlasting. I don't care what the poet said. His vision was short. The everlasting hills are not everlasting. We live in a world where change is the rule, not the exception. Some of the changes are so rapid that we cannot see them. There are changes in nature that take place in less than one billionth of a second. And some of them are so slow that we don't believe them. But it should be seen as a truism for the visible, tangible world that the only thing that doesn't change is that it does change. I've used a bunch of words up to this point. I've said change, I've said development, I've referred to life cycle, expansion, history, unfolding, things of that kind. I've not used another word which I do wish to use now. Let's say that everything is evolving. various features on the surface of the planet itself, the solar system, the galaxy, the universe, they are all evolving. Evolution is all about us. And I want you to understand that this is the norm. I've also limited my list up to this point in that I've stuck to inorganic objects, solid rocks, mountains, so forth. It's only when we get to the most mobile and the most plastic world of all, the world of life, that we suddenly get a loud chorus from people who do not really see that any of these changes are taking place. Everything changes. Everything develops. Everything unfolds. Everything evolves. The organic world, the most fragile of all, evolves along with all of the rest. I'm reminded of a series of controversies, which some of which will be, I'm sure, of interest to you. They are clothed in religious terminology, and they are sometimes pegged to some verses in the Bible. In my opinion, they really don't have anything much to do with the Bible. They have to do with people who are sidetracked. An outstanding example was the flat earth debate. Have you run into that recently? We still have it. People who presumably are intelligent hold today that the planet is a flat four-cornered plate with sharp edges. And if you get too close to one of the edges, you might fall off. I guess we get this from our perception of scenery. You can look out there and see that it's flat. Go up the hill, you come down the other side, it's flat. Or we get it from statements that are attributed to the Bible that the earth has four corners. The visible curvature of our planet, some of us have seen it. The repeated circumnavigations in all directions. The circular shadow cast on the moon, the vast array of data from detailed mapping. I spent some time this morning cutting this talk down from 4.5 hours so that you would appreciate it, and I'm leaving out some of those things about detailed mapping, but the data there are numerous beyond imagination. The evidence from gravity measurements. All of this should have settled the argument long, long ago. But it doesn't make a whole lot of difference how much evidence you have. Some people cannot be persuaded. For them, the earth is flat, and there's no point in talking about it. As the old saying goes, I've already made up my mind, don't confuse me with the facts. A second example was the geocentric system. You know, the earth's the center of everything. It was argued in the early history of this debate that the earth had to be the center of the universe because God had placed mankind here, and after all, we're the center of the universe. In fact, the earth is not centered in any space at all except the space that it occupies. That is, from one side to the other, it's centered exactly where it is, but other than that, it's not centered in anything. Our planet is an undistinguished member. It's neither the biggest, nor the smallest, nor the fattest, nor the thinnest. It's an undistinguished member of an undistinguished star system in the backwaters of a very ordinary galaxy, in a part of space having no claim to fame. I think this is fortunate. We're not number one. And therefore, we have no prestige. And spiritually, this is a very great advantage. A third example is the idea of a universal flood, which we blame on Noah, who knew nothing about it. There is no geological evidence for a universal flood. There is nothing remotely close to being geological evidence for a universal flood. And the Bible account does not require it. The most durable of all of these arguments, however, has been the battle of over evolution. It's not gone away yet. I don't think it will go away. It has its ups and downs, but it stays with us. As some have phrased it, You don't really want a monkey for a grandfather, do you?
Well, no, I don't.
And I don't know anybody who does, including scientists. Furthermore, I don't know of any hypothesis which puts a monkey in my family tree. How he got into the family tree is another matter. He was put there because many people have placed him there arbitrarily, thinking that if they would ram a monkey into my family tree, they could somehow destroy the evidence that bears on the subject. In other words, if we can't win with logic, we will call each other names. Without their help, there is no monkey in the family tree. But isn't a monkey in the family tree the essence of the evolution of the evolution idea? No, it is not. Not even correct. However, this is a real problem for many people. They're bothered by the idea of the monkey. They don't understand some of the words that are used. They don't know what the concept of evolution is. And many of them wish to argue that if God created man, he could not have done it in that way. He has to do it according to the way I think I would have done it. And for these people, any use of the word evolution becomes a manifestation of wickedness, like torture and incest and a few other things. I've spent a good deal of time this morning in an effort to show you that evolution is the norm and it's not the exception. It goes on around you. In terms of what we can see and feel, everything is changing. It all evolves, including the inorganic world. I also would like for us to distinguish between evolution and belief in evolution. That's an important difference. Evolution operates whether you and I believe it or not. Absolutely immaterial. I know people who believe it and people who don't. I refuse to stand up and be... No, that's not right. Most of the geologists I know probably would tell you that they do believe in evolution. That doesn't make any difference either. I do not believe in sunshine. I don't believe in the Big Dipper. I don't believe in trigonometry. I don't believe in waterfalls. I don't believe in mockingbirds. How long a list do you want? I observe them. Sometimes I make use of some of them, but I do not believe in them. To believe in something means to put your faith in it. I place no part of my faith in any of this. Furthermore, I consider it a misdirection of faith to base it in any way that amounts to anything on non-spiritual matters. The evidence concerning evolution is extensive and clear. But I don't care whether it's right or wrong. It's totally immaterial to me. And if tomorrow you show me a better device for tying all of the facts together, I'll be glad to ditch the theory of evolution. That's not just empty talk. It is the business of the scientist to always be testing hypotheses and to turn them upside down when he finds a better one. Therefore, I do not care to say that I believe in evolution or that I do not believe in evolution. But I do not mind saying that until a better hypothesis comes along, I will use the idea. In extreme North Georgia, not very far from the town of Blairsville, is a locality called Track Rock Gap, and that you should visit. The rocks there are Precambrian in age, roughly 1 billion years old. And it is well known, of course, that advanced animals such as vertebrates did not live in Precambrian time. There is a report that there are fossil human footprints in the Precambrian rocks at Track Rock Gap. And this would be a matter of very great interest to us, because if this is correct, either human beings have always lived on the planet, or the geological timescale must be discarded.
Well, with that kind of a challenge, I went over to Track Rock Gap, and there are several footprints over there that make up a trail on a bare rock, a little clearing in the trees and the bushes. Each of the footprints is quite sharp, it's easy to see, easy to study. The trail goes for some little distance over the rock surface, and the rock type is a metamorphic rock. That is one that's been mistreated with heat and pressure so that it's not like it was when it got started. I've now stated for you three rigorous scientific observations. Let's go back and say them again. Now, every one of them eliminates the idea that these are fossil human footprints. Any one by itself. Number one, the prints are sharp. This should be compared with tombstones in the area. Those that are 150 or so years old have carvings on them that are no longer sharp. The tracks at Track Rock Gap and the tombstones in the nearby cemeteries are affected by the same atmosphere and weather at approximately the same rate. And from this one observation, the tracks are sharp. We know that they're not Precambrian, they're not as old as the rocks, and they're not even more than about 200 years old. The second observation, the trail continues for a significant distance up over a little knoll and down the other side on the modern erosion surface. That's not the surface that was there 1,000 years ago. They're on the modern erosion surface. I could get exactly the same results if I take a bucket and a paintbrush and go out there and paint me some footprints on the rock. And that would not make them Precambrian fossils. Number three, the rock is a metamorphic rock, a high rank metamorphic rock. It has been subjected to tremendous heat and pressure and no longer contains anything that you can recognize from its time of origin. I've told this story to various groups on various occasions, and almost invariably, someone says, well, there is some other effect that you don't know anything about, and so those are really Precambrian human footprints. That is total nonsense. These same people should argue with me that $10 plus $10 does not equal $20 because there is some other effect that we don't know anything about. Each line of evidence, I gave you three, by itself destroys the hypothesis that these are Precambrian human fossils, despite the efforts of some people to stick with that hypothesis. I hope you're persuaded about Track Rock Gap. I hope you go look at it. If you understand what I'm telling you about Track Rock Gap, then I will tell you something else about it. These are carvings. They are evidences of human activity sometime in the last couple of centuries. They are equally sharp around the instep as around the rest of the foot. Try making a footprint like that sometime. They have equal depth at all points. The flattest feet on the campus can't do that. Furthermore, from one print to the next one, they're not the same size and do not have the same number of toes. I made a mistake on the so-called footprints at Track Rock Gap. I don't know who made them. Indians, perhaps, for ceremonial purposes? Boy Scouts? Daniel Boone? Who knows? But I will guarantee you that they have nothing to do with the length of Precambrian time, the age of the earth, the antiquity of man, the date of creation, or the reliability of dating procedures. Nothing. There's a vast literature in existence now based on non-data fabrication, distortion. It is labeled as scientific by its proponents, and then it is passed off on the gullible in an effort to prove a late creation.
It is garbage. It is poisonous garbage. Even if it turns out that late creation is right, the earth was created last Friday night. It's garbage. I say this with assurance for two reasons. Number one, the logic is dishonest. And number two, I do not wish any package of errors presented in support of any truth, or even of my faith. The simple fact is that we have an unprecedented record. It is much more detailed, extensive, and complete than any book you have ever seen anywhere. It contains tens of millions or perhaps hundreds of millions of fossils through hundreds of millions of years, arranged in a systematic array from the simplest as the oldest to the most complex as the latest. And the gaps in the record do not spoil the story any more than tearing a few pages out of the dictionary prevent me from reading the definitions on the pages that remain. I'm not concerned about whether or not the theory of evolution is right. I do note, however, in the world of science, there is no other theory. I don't object to another one. If you can develop one that meets the criteria of science and that will be an improvement over the theory of evolution, I would be delighted. I will recommend you for an honorary degree. Get doctored easily. If you happen to have a personal or a private revelation from God explaining that it was really done in some other way and that the theory of evolution is wrong, I can only say that personal private revelations carry zero weight in the world of science. I want us to be sure that we know what we're saying today. The array of data is unbelievably extensive, and it documents a long, slow development from the simple to the complex. The theory of evolution was invented to explain the data. It is certainly possible that it will turn out to be wrong, but it is the only scientific theory now available, and we will continue to teach it until a better one has been worked out. Do I believe in the theory of evolution? Don't be silly. I use it. Why does a religious person feel that he must have scientific support for his faith? Is it that his faith is so weak that it cannot stand by itself but must have a crutch labeled proof? No matter how flimsy. I look back over evidences of the problem. Christian Science has nothing to do with science. Must be an effort to put a gloss of some kind on a religious variation. Scientology, for example, is no more science than witchcraft or astrology or the Ouija board. It cannot appeal to the gullible, especially the gullible with money, without the trappings of science. So-called creation science fits in that category. I seek no scientific confirmation for my faith. I don't want it. As a Christian, I do not care how the world was made or when the world was made. As a Christian, I'm concerned about why the world was made and what role I have in answering that question in my life. As a scientist, I observe the evidence of how and when, but I see no hint or shred of a why. I do not need to find one of the original nails from the cross. I do not need to see Abraham's tomb or Moses' grave marker. I am not upset that the Shroud of Turin was painted with studio paints. I do not accept blurred photographs of rock ledges purporting to be the remains of Noah's Ark.
and I would not accept a piece of the planking with Noah's name on it. I do not want a faith that is based on mere scientific data. Because science, like everything else in this world, is evolving. And I do not believe that God evolves. God created the world, and he saw fit to place me in it. He does not shield me from falling meteorites or from drops of rain. I sunburn just like the non-Christian. And germs do not recognize the fact that I belong to a church. But God did place me here. I say that as an article of faith. And he walks with me as I try to understand, to admire, to contemplate, and to cope with the evolving world which he created.